choosing to fight ISIS today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. At age 21, American Lucas Chapman decided to join the fight against ISIS in Syria. Soon he found himself literally walking through a minefield with a Kurdish fighter.
He turns around, he says something to me in Kurdish, and I didn't get it, so I said, I'm sorry. And he just looked around and he made this little walking motion with his fingers, and then he went, boom!
Now he's trying to adjust to life back in the U.S. We'll have that story. Plus, Ireland's new prime minister is raising hopes and a few eyebrows.
It's sort of a slicker, more accomplished version of what Trump has done in the States. You sell the image rather than sell the policy.
Those stories, plus why you might want to think twice about the facial recognition feature on that iPhone 10 today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We often start this show with a big story from somewhere around the globe. Today, though, we want to begin with a more personal one, one that connects all of us to one of those big stories, the war in Syria. The conflict there can feel remote to us here, but Americans are involved. Some have been sent there by the U.S. military, and some, as we're about to hear, have gone to Syria on their own to join the fighting, not to join ISIS, as others from the West have done, but to fight against ISIS by joining the ranks of Kurdish fighters in Syria. Technically, that's not illegal. From a U.S. government point of view, these Americans are helping in the fight against the so-called Islamic State in Syria. But what is it like for them? Here's The World's Shirin Jafari.
It was October 1st, the dead of night. Lucas Chapman was as close as he'd ever been to realizing his dream. He was finally getting smuggled into Syria from Iraq, on foot.
The entire walk was about 7 hours, so even after the first maybe half hour, just walking up and down these kind of gentle hills, I was like wheezing, you know, like gasping for air.
He had his big, heavy backpack on. No flashlights. It would draw attention. No water because it slushes around and makes noise. It was like nothing he'd ever done before. Halfway through the trek, one of Chapman's Kurdish guides stopped him.
He turns around, he says something to me in Kurdish, and I didn't get it, so I said, I'm sorry, I didn't get that. And he just looked around and he made this little walking motion with his fingers, and then he went, boom! I said, oh, mines. He said, yes, yes, mine, mine. Everywhere, he like motioned around, everywhere. So you bet that my nose was up the butt of the guy in front of me after hearing that. I just stuck right on him, which actually is very poor military practice, walking through a minefield, but I didn't know that at the time.
That night was also Chapman's 21st birthday. But it didn't matter. He had made up his mind about going to Syria 2 years before. He was in college at the time, majoring in history. He saw news footage of the Islamic State rolling into Syria, and he promised himself that if the war was still going on, by the time he graduated, he would drop everything and go.
And then 2016 rolled around, and I graduated in May of that year, and I had to walk the walk, so to speak.
He decided to volunteer for a Kurdish militia group called the YPG, or the People's Protection Unit. They control a chunk of territory in northern Syria. They call it Rojava. And really, it was the group's ideology that pulled him in.
It's part anarchism, part communism, part socialism. Everyone gets a voice. That's what appealed to me so much about it.
Right now we're in Ain Issa, getting ready for the Raqqa operation.
This is a video of Chapman in Syria. He's small with dark-rimmed glasses. He's wearing a military uniform.
I'm very excited to go to the front. Yeah.
Chapman spent 7 months as a volunteer fighter with the YPG. First, there was training. Then there were times when he was on the front lines. Others, when he and his American buddy had to sit around, bored. He shows me some photos on his iPhone.
So this is me at like we just had a morale night. Put a little fire on the roof, set a little tire on fire, and danced around and ate some donuts and drank some soda.
Where did you get donuts?
Those are reserved for the best of nights, for the morale nights. They weren't fresh or anything, they're just in packages, but it tasted just as good as the fresh at that point.
Thousands of foreign fighters have gone to Syria since the start of the civil war. Some have joined the Islamic State, some have gone to fight against it. It's hard to know exactly how many Americans have gone, but some estimates put the number at 100. Volunteers I spoke to say this is too low. They figure it's about 200 to 300, maybe even more. So what pushes these Americans to leave their comfortable first world lives and go fight in another man's war? Chapman and his friends divide them into three groups. The adventurers, you know, Rambo types. The ones who sympathize with the leftist ideology of the YPG, like Chapman himself, and the vets.
Those that are military veterans, some of them are going because they missed military lifestyle.
Jason Fritz is with the American University in Washington, D.C. He and his team interviewed a dozen of the volunteers when they came back to the U.S.
Many of them had deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan with the U.S. Army or the U.S. Marines. You also had a number of veterans who just didn't like seeing all of the work that they did and why, you know, some of them were wounded or they had friends who were wounded or killed being undone by the Islamic State.
That's exactly how Buck Clay felt in 2014 when ISIS was gaining strength. Clay had served 11 years in the U.S. Army.
I did 3 years of my life in Iraq, so to watch it all be flushed away, you know, it was like something was being taken from me, like everything, my contribution, the contribution of the people who went with me or, you know, the people who didn't make it back. And it just, you know, it was all being swept away.
Clay was working for an electrical supply company in Ohio at the time. Not the most exciting chapter of his life, he says. So he saved up money and got ready to leave.
I put all my stuff in storage. I sold my car. I gave proper notice for my job. We even had a little going away party and prepared to leave for an unknown amount of time.
In the end, Clay says he spent $8,000 on his trip to Syria. Was it worth it? Did he feel like he accomplished what he was after?
Nope, not at all. That's why I haven't gone back. It felt like a waste. I don't think I contributed much at all.
He says there was too much emphasis on ideology, something he found tough to embrace.
The YPG, they wanted me to join the Communist Party and they wanted me to be a poster boy. And that's all they wanted from me.
He was done. After 4 months, he headed back to the U.S. So how does a Texan or, say, a New Yorker find his or her way into a Kurdish militia group in Syria? It's actually not that hard. Do a little Googling, and in no time, emails and phone numbers will show up on your screen. All right, I've just talked to somebody from the YPG on WhatsApp, and I am just going to give them a call.
Morning.
Hi, who am I speaking to?
Zagros.
Zagros?
Yes.
Zagros isn't his real name, and he won't tell me where he is. But he walks me through the process. He says when a foreign volunteer asks to join the group, first they send them a long list of questions. And there's a reason for that.
There was not any procedure at the beginning, at the first year. It was 3-4 years ago. Because we were in a very intense fight, we would accept almost everyone to come. Then we realized this is not the way that we should do it, because some of the people came with their own problem, their own psychological problem, and we had to clear them out. We had to ask them to leave.
Jason Fritz of the American University also worries about who ends up holding a gun in a place where there's no rule of law. He says Americans wandering off to Syria like that just raises so many questions.
What about their conduct on the battlefield? If they did engage in violence against unarmed civilians and then such things, you know, there really isn't a lot of recourse. What happens if, I don't know, like the Syrian government captures one? You know, now the U.S. is, they're not compelled to take action, but at some point it could become a diplomatic headache.
He also wonders what happens if they get captured by the Islamic State. The U.S. doesn't officially pay ransom to terrorist groups. Both Chapman and Clay, the volunteers I spoke with, say they always saved an extra bullet, just in case. Better dead than an ISIS prisoner, they said. Of course, not all Americans who've gone have made it back.
When you arrive and after you've gone through some training, they have you make a video, in case I die type of video, and they kind of take down your wishes.
My name is Nicholas Allen Warden. I'm from Buffalo, New York. I was born on June 17th.
Just in July, at least three Americans died in Syria fighting ISIS. Nicholas Warden was one of them. This is him in a video the YPG released after his death.
I'd like to say hi to my parents in New York.
I asked Zagros, the YPG guy, what happens when Americans like Warden die? Who takes care of their bodies?
It's on their willing of their family. If they want to have them back, we will send them back. Otherwise, we have a international martyrs graveyard here, so we keep them as our own.
He won't tell me exactly how many Americans are buried in the international graveyard, but Chapman told me he carried the casket of one American who's buried in Rojava in northern Syria. He says he had asked the same be done with him if he died.
I said, look, Jewish custom dictates that I have to be buried as soon as possible. So if that means that I have to be buried in Rojava, then, you know, bury me in Rojava. That's where I want to go.
Despite the risks, Americans continue to join the fight against the Islamic State.
There's always an appeal and a kind of romance in the idea of joining some very distant fight for a good cause.
Adam Hochschild, author of a book called Spain in Our Hearts, says it's not hard to find other examples in history where Americans have gone off to fight in a foreign war. In the mid-1930s, some 2,800 Americans boarded steamboats from New York and headed to France and then Spain to fight against the fascist dictator, Francisco Franco.
Most, though by no means all of them, were members or supporters of the Communist Party. And those 2,800 Americans going to Spain were by far the largest number of Americans who'd ever gotten involved in somebody else's civil war.
This is a true face of men going into action. It is a little different from any other face that you will ever see.
Famously, Ernest Hemingway made it to Spain, for whom The Bell Tolls is based on his experiences there. He also narrated this documentary, The Spanish Earth.
Men cannot act before the camera in the presence of death.
Hochschild sees a parallel between the Spanish War and the Syrian one, but he's also cautious about the differences for those going to Syria.
I think the volunteers who are going there, although I deeply respect their good intentions, they're stepping into a very complicated political cauldron with major state actors like the United States, Russia, Iran, Turkey, all maneuvering around the edge of this situation. I think it's a little bit less clear-cut than the Spanish Civil War was, where at the time, even though there were political complexities there too, it was really a question of, did you want or did you not want Hitler and Mussolini to have another ally in Europe?
But for today's volunteers, these complexities are just footnotes. Like this guy who didn't want to give me his name.
Yeah, can you hear me?
He says he's in Germany waiting to get the green light from the YPG. He's a student, a city boy. He hasn't held a gun in his life. But he's a leftist and admires the American volunteers who fought in the Spanish Civil War.
Each generation gets only a limited amount of opportunities to actually make a difference in the world. For me and like-minded individuals, the Rojava Revolution is the Spanish Civil War of our time.
The Spanish Civil War of our time. Certainly felt that way for Lucas Chapman. And since he's been back, he hears from people who want advice on how to get to Syria. He tries to persuade them not to go.
Because I have lost a lot of people, and it really shook me, like having interacted with these guys, knowing about their families. Some of them left daughters behind, little kids.
He tells them find another way to help, become an activist, for example. And that's actually what he's done. He works for a Kurdish NGO in Washington, D.C. They lobby, hold rallies, and help the families of Americans who've died in Syria.
But if there's nothing I can do, then I think back to myself. And I think, okay, there's nothing that could have stopped me. So I would much rather give this person advice, help them prepare to go over there, and try as hard as I can to keep them from coming back in a body bag.
Just the day before we met, Chapman says he managed to talk one would-be volunteer out of going to Syria. Success. But for each person who changes their mind, there seems to be another one on their way. For the world, Shirin Jafari. Viva la Quinta Brigada, rumba la rumba la rumba la. Viva la Quinta Brigada, rumba la rumba la rumba la. Que nos cubrirá de glorias, ay Carmela, ay Carmela.
This is the late Chilean singer Rolando Alarcón with an ode to those who fought on the resistance side of the Spanish Civil War. Up next is Ireland's new prime minister, a case of style over substance. You're with the world.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
Marco Werman here with The World. In June, Ireland got a prime minister, a new prime minister, or Taoiseach. He's Leo Varadkar, and he's been getting a lot of international press. That's because he's the son of an Indian immigrant, and he's openly gay. When he took office, Varadkar promised to build a republic of opportunity for everyone, but already there's grumbling that he's more style than substance. Don Duncan has a story from Dublin.
Ireland, which, as you know, has seen a real social transformation in recent years.
That's Leo Varadkar during a visit to Canada a few weeks back. He's been busy this summer making trips, building an international image, and pursuing trade opportunities. But back here in Ireland, people are getting restless.
Where is the Taoiseach? Well, Taoiseach's in Canada.
George Hook is a popular Irish radio host. His is one of a growing number of voices calling on Varadkar to stop with the overseas photo ops and start with the problems at home, like housing and the economy.
And while he was there, the Taoiseach decided to attend a gay pride march. I think he should be attending a homeless march. I think he should be attending a balanced budget march so that we would actually have some government.
Just 3 months ago, Varadkar was welcomed as a breath of fresh air. Now, some see him more as a PR-obsessed spin machine.
It's sort of a slicker, more accomplished version of what Trump has done in the States. You sell the image rather than sell the policy.
Lorcan Nagel is a volunteer with the Abortion Rights Campaign. He's handing out flyers in central Dublin in support of a referendum to legalise abortion.
So I've got two flyers here.
Nagel's group is frustrated because after Varadkar committed to holding a referendum next year, he stayed silent on the language and even the date of the vote. And he's been evasive about his own position on abortion. Part of the frustration may be rooted in unrealistic expectations. Some on the left had hoped Varadkar, as a gay man and son of an immigrant, would usher in a progressive agenda for his centre-right party, Fine Gael. But Varadkar has held fast to his conservative politics. Nagel says it's been a lesson for the left.
I think that there's an assumption that if someone is in LGBT, that they are therefore automatically going to be with us on everything else. That's a bad assumption on the part of the left wing.
But the current discontent with Varadkar is broader than just left and right, especially when it comes to the housing crisis.
So I'm saying to Leo Varadkar, stand up! Take control.
A group of about 50 hold a candlelit vigil outside Parliament for three homeless people who died in the same week.
What do we want?
Homes for the homeless!
Rents are rising and Ireland is unable to build enough housing to meet demand. That's because of a cap on public spending related to the country's bailout. And the private construction sector is struggling to access credit, another legacy of the recession. Activist Alan Buckley calls it an emergency that Leo Varadkar is doing nothing about.
Jack Watson, a person, died on your watch, Leo. You are keep telling us that we live in a country that's improving, that the economy is growing, and it's a f***ing whitewash.
Varadkar's office declined an interview for this story, but the leader has said his government plans to build about 2,500 public housing units this year after near zero output for many years. He's also vowed to fight waste in the public healthcare system. Promises are well and good, says analyst Johnny Fallon, but Varadkar will have to come up with concrete action once Parliament reconvenes next Wednesday.
He needs to prove that he's a real heavyweight politician, and thus far that has been a challenge for him.
Becoming a heavyweight, says Fallon, involves making tough, divisive and risky political decisions. And while the Irish electorate traditionally has rewarded doers, even if their decisions don't work out,
what they're very unforgiving of is the idea of doing nothing or avoiding it. They really dislike that.
Varadkar became Taoiseach when his party's leader stepped down. So he's not the people's choice. Yet. And though he's still very popular with his party's followers, that party only holds power through a tenuous coalition. He has until next year's general election to win over his growing critics. For The World, Don Duncan, Dublin.
In Britain, as in the US, the transgender rights movement has made big gains in recent years. And like here, there's still a lot of opposition, especially when it comes to what happens in schools. The World's Leo Hornack in London has been telling us about one case in particular that's been getting a lot of attention.
Earlier this year, a Christian couple, Nigel and Sally Rowe, who have a 6-year-old son, heard from their son's school that one of the other students had decided to begin wearing both male and female clothing in class. And they felt, in their words, that this failed to consider their right to bring up a child with biblical values. They responded by withdrawing their son from the school, and they're considering a legal challenge. Here's how Nigel, the father, described how he thought about the school's decision to accept the trans kids in their class.
We have a social understanding that we have boys and we have girls. We feel that there's a political agenda that's sort of driving and pushing this. Remember, we're talking children that are 6 years of age. I mean, a 6-year-old is not really able to, doesn't have the mental capacity to work out those kind of things. It's such a young age, and we're concerned about that.
What kind of reaction have you been hearing from the public about this story?
Well, that's, of course, with these things which are so politicized, it's very difficult to know really what the public think. I mean, what you do have is social media and Twitter. And when you look on there, you'll see a lot of people being highly critical of this couple's decision, and particularly their decision to make this a public issue rather than just quietly changing school or finding some solution, negotiating a solution with the school. But having said that, I think there is a difference here between how the UK and maybe the US has kind of negotiated the changing norms over gender. And I think the real difference you see here is that it's not party political. It is political, but it's not party political in quite the same way. So, for example, David Cameron, Conservative Prime Minister until a few years ago, he was the one who pushed through marriage equality in Britain. And earlier this year, we have a Conservative government right now, but it's a Conservative government that is proposing to bring in a Gender Recognition Act, which is going to make it easier for trans people to change gender in terms of bureaucracy. So the kinds of very sharp dividing line that you see in the US, if you're Democrat, you support many of these things. If you're Republican, you almost certainly are much more skeptical about changing gender norms. That hard divide doesn't exist, which means people can kind of bumble along, kind of bounce along, and come to a much more negotiated settlement in politics about these issues. Or at least that seems to be how things are developing.
Has acceptance of trans people been easier in Britain, do you think?
Well, I mean, that is very difficult to say, Marco. But even if things in some ways seem a little more liberal from the way the government's attitude has evolved, I think there's no doubt that it can be very dangerous and very traumatic being trans and in school in Britain, just as in the US. And there was one very sad, in a way, survey that was recently done in Britain that found that not only are 2 in 3 trans students in schools have been bullied, but 2 in 5 have actually tried to commit suicide.
Wow.
So when we talk about a more optimistic tone to how the political debate is going, I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's still a very, very tough time.
That was the World's Leo Hornack there in London.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Jugmeet Singh is a Canadian politician. He's also a Sikh who knows what it's like to confront bigotry and hate.
Hate is not something that's very limited. It's not something that picks and chooses. It's more like a fire. And once we allow it to exist, it spreads. And so we need to stop it in its tracks.
How Singh stopped one recent heckler, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Facial recognition. That's all I'm going to say to get us into this next story about a new smartphone on the market that was released yesterday, just trying to avoid excessive free advertising for Apple. But there is a serious issue around the new super advanced and super expensive iPhone X that we need to talk about. For starters, it comes with an even slicker login system than its current Touch ID, which lets you in through your fingerprint. The iPhone X uses facial recognition, and as with any Apple unveiling, there's been praise and skepticism. Many are raising questions about what the new system will mean for privacy and security. We often turn to Zeynep Tufekci to answer questions about these things. She studies the intersection of technology and society at the University of North Carolina. So what are some of the questions that immediately came to your mind, Zeynep, when you heard that Apple would be rolling out this facial recognition feature on its newest iPhone?
Well, the first thing I wanted to know was whether the data would be stored locally on the phone and properly encrypted, or would it be sent to Apple's main servers? Because the fingerprint was stored locally on just your phone and didn't ever leave it. Now, fortunately, the facial recognition data is also stored only on the phone and it is encrypted. But there's a big twist. Legally speaking, the courts have so far said that if you have your Apple phone locked with a PIN, you cannot be compelled to unlock the PIN without a warrant. Whereas the police, if they've arrested you, they can physically pick up your phone and your finger and compel you to unlock that phone with your fingerprint. It's not protected by the Fifth Amendment the same way the PIN is. So while even the existence of such biometric passcodes creates all these legal issues, and very often law doesn't treat, you know, the biometrics the same as a passphrase or a PIN.
Well, a lot of this came up in 2015 and 16 with the San Bernardino attack. The FBI was trying to open up the iPhone of one of the shooters in that attack. Apple refused. But with facial recognition, couldn't law enforcement just hold the phone up to the face of the suspect, whether they are alive or dead, and get into the phone?
Presumably. And it's going to really be interesting to see what the legal test would be. But we shouldn't just think Apple. We shouldn't just think U.S. either. This is the infrastructure of authoritarianism, to have this kind of facial recognition. So if you're a protest, a nation state, or a large platform, large company, it's going to be able to quickly scan its database of faces and say, that's where you were. And this is going to be true since there are cameras everywhere and there are sensors in more and more places. This is going to be true in all sorts of things we do.
I imagine, Zeynep, you see some of these nightmare scenarios applied to demonstrators, for example, in Turkey, who might get arrested.
Well, I think these nightmare scenarios are applicable everywhere. What we have here is the automation at scale of the ability to identify where people have been at every point. The worry here is that these technologies are here, they're going to be used, they're going to be used without our consent, and they're going to be used at scale. So we need both technical solutions and we need legal frameworks. And I am worried that it's just normalizing facial recognition more than I'm worried about how Apple is implementing its particular version of this.
Zeynep Tufekci studies the intersection of technology and society at the University of North Carolina. Thanks so much. Good to speak with you again.
Thank you for inviting me.
As parts of the U.S. and the Caribbean begin to recover after Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, let's not forget what happened south of the border, because Mexico is also reeling after devastating natural disasters. An 8.1 magnitude earthquake, the largest in a century, rocked the country last Thursday, killing nearly 100 people. And a day later, Hurricane Katia made landfall in Mexico and caused a deadly mudslide. Recovery efforts are underway, but thousands of buildings have been flattened and emergency supplies are still desperately needed. Journalist Frank Contreras is based in Mexico City. He just got back from reporting in some of the hardest hit areas. What did you see just a few days after the quake, Frank? What was the extent of the damage?
Marco, I traveled to a place called Juchitan. It's an indigenous town, maybe about 20,000 people or so. We spent about 3 or 4 days directly following the quake. And what we saw were probably about 40% of all the buildings in that town were either turned to absolute rubble or damaged beyond repair. So we saw a number of families sleeping out at night in front of their homes, just kind of waiting for relief to come or even waiting for another aftershock. There were some 900 aftershocks registered and a powerful one on Monday, 5.2.
You must have heard some pretty frightening stories, Frank, when you were down there.
the people we spoke with said, you know, they were dealing with some really basic concerns, housing, getting food, and even things like water. I spoke to a woman who said she was asleep in bed with her newborn infant and the ceiling caved in on top of them. They struggled to get through the house, kind of getting past the falling chunks of concrete from the ceiling. They got out into the yard. The ground was still moving. Their house just demolished. We met them at a shelter. They told this story, and they were just surprised that they're still alive. Juchitán, in that part of Mexico, had the vast majority of the deaths. The numbers of deaths are now heading toward 100. But the biggest issue right now is that more than 40,000 people in that region are left without homes.
You know, Mexico offered aid to the U.S. to help victims of Hurricane Harvey last week, even as President Trump was attacking Mexico on Twitter. Now President Enrique Peña Nieto says they'll be redirecting those resources to help with recovery efforts after the earthquake there. What is the plan?
That's right. Texas Governor Greg Abbott was slow in accepting aid from Mexico, finally did. But then suddenly we got hit here in Mexico. And as you said, this was the worst earthquake to hit Mexico in more than a century. So this was devastating. The Army has been in place and they've been working since the earthquake hit. So they're first responders. We saw mobile medical units on location staffed with doctors, nurses, and even psychologists. Mm. They said the biggest problem people are suffering, you can imagine, it's panic attacks.
I have to ask you too, Frank, was Mexico's take back of those resources partly driven by anger at Trump for his insensitivity toward Mexico as it was battling natural disasters? What do you think?
I know that Mexican citizens I spoke with were very put off. You know, Mexico offered help, as it did, by the way, when Katrina hit. And this time it was kind of not very friendly response and all of the kind of negativity that was coming from the White House. So people were put off. I think the government is very astute and they won't say that sort of thing for the record for journalists. But you do get the sense that that was the feeling here.
Yeah, and we have yet to hear condolences from the White House for the victims of the earthquake in Mexico. So the government in Mexico is primed for responding to disasters. Do Mexicans, do the people trust the government in these recovery operations?
I would say the answer is not exactly. People right away were on social media asking me, Frank, how can we donate? And when we finally got information about an account that was set up. It was set up, by the way, by a very famous artist in Oaxaca, Francisco Toledo. And when I published that on Facebook, a number of people here quickly doubted it, saying that, you know, those are probably politicians who will use it for their own personal enrichment. So there's this massive rift still between the trust of the people and the government.
And an election is coming up in Mexico, so that trust is crucial right now.
People have that sense that distribution of resources could get involved with electoral politics here, and this is not a new thing in Mexico.
So for people in Oaxaca and Chiapas, how long is it going to be before things approach normal again?
Well, the best example I could give you comes from my own daughter. She lives in Oaxaca City, a good distance from the isthmus where the most terrible trembling was felt in that earthquake. But she says that kids are really scared. Some kids are asking to go to psychologists. People are really frightened. They're feeling the aftershocks and wondering, could it happen again?
Reporter Frank Contreras in Mexico City, just back from the epicenter of last week's earthquake. Thank you for your time, Frank. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
Of course, the U.S. is dealing with its own natural disasters. Texas and Florida are getting a lot of coverage, not to mention relief, after visits from Harvey and Irma. But here at the World, we've also been monitoring the other places where Hurricane Irma caused widespread damage, like the U.S. Virgin Islands, the U.S. territory in the Caribbean that includes St. Thomas, St. John, and St. Croix, along with several much smaller islands. There was widespread destruction there, thousands of people left homeless. Food has been scarce, and relief has been slow to reach these remote Caribbean islands, which got me thinking, how did these islands ever end up as U.S. possessions? Perfect question for the world's history guy, Chris Wolfe.
Well, the actual transfer took place in 1917 when the United States purchased them from Denmark, the Kingdom of Denmark, in far-off Europe. And the reason they shelled out $25 million, which is about more than $500 million in today's money, was to get control of the harbour. The islands, as I said, belong to the Kingdom of Denmark, and they were afraid that because World War One was underway, that the Germans would seize control of Denmark and thereby be able to establish like a submarine base in the Virgin Islands and then attack US shipping from there. So it was all about insecurity and strategic concerns.
Well, I know the French and the Dutch and the Americans and the British all have territories in the Caribbean, but the Danes, what were the Danes doing in the West Indies?
Well, they came to the West Indies just like all the other European nations you mentioned to try and make money, either to raid the Spanish or to like build plantations that could grow things that you couldn't get in Europe, which you could sell at a huge profit. It was a hugely profitable business, and a business, unfortunately, built on the backs of slavery.
Yeah. How much was the growth of the islands due to slave labor?
Pretty much all of it. From a very early date, people were imported to enslaved and imported from Africa and forced to work in these brutal conditions in these plantations. And the Danish islands also had this, became an enormous, I hate to use the word, market, where people were brought in and sold and shipped all over the Caribbean in these degrading conditions. It's appalling.
Yeah, well, that's what slavery was. It was a market. And Haiti, I mean, we think of it as the place where there was this successful slave rebellion. Was there ever a rebellion in the Virgin Islands?
Yeah, there was all the usual forms of resistance you find in plantation culture in the Caribbean. But I think the island of St. John stands out because in 1733, the enslaved population rose up and seized control of the whole island for 6 months before the Danish and their French friends were able to come in and unfortunately put the revolt down.
And this is now the U.S. Virgin Islands where this revolt took place.
Correct.
Yeah. So if the islands were Danish at one point, how come most of the people there speak English Creole today?
Well, the Danish never really cared about settling it. They would love skimming off the money. They didn't have the particular skills, you know, required capital and brutality to, you know, make successful plantations. So a lot of English people moved there, including, you may remember, Alexander Hamilton's family when his mother moved to St. Croix from St. Kitts and lived there for many years. So there was long been a tradition of English and Scottish white people moving there, and obviously they influenced the language.
Who were the original inhabitants of the Virgin Islands?
Well, it's incredible the amount of history packed into these tiny islands. You've had piracy in the islands. You've had slavery, slave revolts. And before that, there was, unfortunately, genocide. The islands were a center of resistance by the Native American peoples, the Siboney, the Arawak, the Carib, and others, against the Spanish invasion of Puerto Rico. So the Spanish responded with this incredibly brutal campaign of violence to exterminate or enslave the entire populations of these islands. And also, obviously, they were wrestling with incredible problems with imported European diseases as well, which took a heavy, heavy toll. But they didn't disappear entirely. The DNA continues in many of the inhabitants of the islands merged with the African population.
So there are the U.S. Virgin Islands. There's also the British Virgin Islands, which were terribly hit by Hurricane Irma. What is the Virgin in the Virgin Islands? What does that refer to?
Well, the islands actually were named by Christopher Columbus himself, 1493. He comes by and for some reason happens on the name of one of the most obscure saints, St. Ursula, and her 11,000 virgins who are allegedly martyred in the early Christian days in Europe. But she's so obscure and so poorly documented that she actually was struck off the official Vatican list of saints in 1969.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, telling it all. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Meanwhile, the cleanup from Harvey continues in Texas, and the World's Monica Campbell was recently in Houston, where she spent a day with some young Muslim men who were volunteering to help in the recovery.
We just passed an apartment complex, and we...
Wow, everything is on the street.
Yeah.
It's like the houses just...
This is a typical scene.
Wow.
So we see everything. Chest of drawers is out, desks, lamps, sofas, all the heavy stuff.
Not this one, the next one.
Refrigerators, televisions.
It's as if houses were completely turned inside out. How do you decide where to stop, who to help? How are you guys going about this?
Well, we're a bunch of young men, so we focus on heavy lifting first. And we know that these families aren't going to be able to do that by themselves. So we ask them to identify, hey, what are the heavy things that you think you're going to have trouble?
Cleaning up Houston and trying to change people's image of Muslims in America in the process. More of that story tomorrow here on The World. Becoming a naturalized U.S. citizen is usually a pretty joyous event for those people who take the step.
It is a moment where one feels a kind of transformation, this making of a new citizen, if you will. Everybody stands up and takes the oath, and everybody thinks about what it means to be joining this new society.
That's physician and Harvard professor Ahmed Raghab. He was born in Egypt and became a U.S. citizen just last Thursday. The ceremony took place here in Boston at Faneuil Hall. Raghab says he really took to heart the speech that the judge gave that day.
She explained the new rights that we are acquiring as citizens and also the new responsibilities that we're having. It felt that now we have actually a say in what this country should look like.
Yeah, apparently you took that responsibility quite seriously because after you left Faneuil Hall, tell us where you went next.
After Faneuil Hall, we drove to Harvard Square, and there colleagues of ours from Harvard and from different schools across the Boston area were organizing a protest in support of our DACA students, a nonviolent act of civil disobedience.
Right. And important point here, you were arrested.
That's correct. Yes.
So you wrote about the experience for The Washington Post today, and I noted beneath the article various comments, some of them quite angry. And one says, LOL, first act as an American citizen is to go out and break the law, disrupting the lives of innocent fellow citizens and proud of it. How would you respond to that comment?
You know, we could disagree on what we believe is right, but disruption is actually a democratic tradition. This country is not built by the acts of few politicians deciding what the laws should be like. The laws and whatever gains the citizens have in this country were fought for in the streets.
Well, Dr. Raghab, you might not think you were abusing your new citizenship, but if others do, can you respect that?
Of course. Absolutely. I think it is absolutely everybody's right to protest and to pronounce their opinions and to share and contribute to the making of this country. It is indeed our duty to stand in juries and to be judges of our peers. It is our duty to participate in the decision making, and it is our duty to stand for what we believe is right.
So you were born in Egypt, grew up there, and went to medical school in Cairo. Did you engage in any public disobedience then?
Yes. I was part of political activism in Egypt for quite some time. In fact, I was in one of the protests in June 2010, which were just before the revolution 2011 that ousted Mubarak. Obviously, here, the rights of individuals to protest are way more protected than they are in many other parts around the world. And that's a fact that is particularly clear to me. But again, because your rights are protected, because your rights to protest are protected, your duty to protest is even more important.
So the district attorney dropped the charges against you and the case was dismissed. That does seem kind of like a privilege some protesters might not have if they weren't a Harvard professor. Did that privilege also feel very American too?
It is definitely a privilege. As a friend of mine put it, you know, we're trying to bridge this gap between law and justice. So again, the privilege comes with the responsibility. It comes with the responsibility to lend your voice, lend your body to what you believe in.
Ahmed Raghab, physician and associate professor at Harvard, and now a proud protesting American. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to meet a Canadian politician now. His name is Jagmeet Singh. He's a lawmaker in Ontario and running for the national leadership of the NDP. That's Canada's third largest party. And as a follower of the Sikh faith, Jagmeet Singh also happens to wear a beard and a turban. Last week, Singh was holding a campaign meet and greet when a heckler started shouting at him. She accused him of supporting Sharia law and extremist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood.
When is your Sharia going to end? It's, we know you're about the Muslim Brotherhood. We can tell by your votes. We all know.
But instead of confronting the woman, Singh told her she is loved and valued repeatedly.
We welcome you. We love you. We support you and we love you.
Until she stopped shouting and left the hall. The whole thing was caught on video and, you guessed it, it went viral. Now, Jagmeet Singh, you're getting a lot of praise on social media and in mainstream media for your response to this woman. You didn't get mad. You didn't try and kick her out of the event. You didn't say, I'm not a Muslim. You don't get it. You stayed really calm. What was your thinking? What was the thought process and why did you respond that way?
Well, I wanted to really signal the theme of our campaign and what I've been about and why I'm running to become the next Prime Minister of Canada is that I want to build a more inclusive Canada. I want to build a more inclusive society. And to do that, we need to welcome and embrace people and show them that we can challenge hate with love. And I wanted to set the tone for the room. This was a room filled with my supporters, and they're seeing someone walk right up to me and get really aggressive and almost violent. And I wanted to quickly say, listen, it's okay. We're not afraid of this. We're not afraid of any hate. We're not afraid of any attacks. We are going to confront that with love, and we will overcome.
All right. So what I really want to know, Jagmeet, and again, I'm speaking from south of the Canadian border here, and I know things are kind of mellower north of the border, but when is it okay to get mad? Like, as a person of color who was attacked, why is it on you to be calm and hold your anger and swallow your hurt?
Well, I think it's important to highlight that love encourages the response. But in my case, I chose to show love and courage in the fashion of saying, I respect you and I welcome you. But there's a lot of people in the room that showed love and courage in a different way. The people that are my dear friends and people that are part of my staff, they wanted to protect me. They saw someone attacking me, and their response to this was to come in front and try to block and protect me. So that was also a response in love and courage. There was also some people in the room that were trying to call out and name the injustice and say, this is wrong what you're doing. And so that was also a response. I think it's important to acknowledge that there are many ways to respond to hate. And some of those ways were exhibited in that room. I chose one particular way. But there's no one way. We're complex human beings, and there's complex ways to respond to hurt and to violence.
Do you worry that if you had responded to this woman in a more heated way, that might have backfired?
You know, it's a fair analysis. People have made the comparison that in the States, if you had any politician in a context like that and someone came up into the face, into the physical space of a politician, they would have immediately been thrown out, or people would have been justified to yell at them. The contrast, though, I'm a racialized person with someone that approached me, you know, if I had responded with that, what would be the public reaction? It's an important thing to note and to think about. For me, there wasn't a question, though. I knew that in that moment, in that split second, there was only one response for me, and that was to make sure that I exhibited the beliefs and the values that I have, which are that we need to accept and love all people. We need to challenge hate, not accept hate, oppose it. I chose a pathway of using love as a response.
Jagmeet Singh is a politician in Ontario. His response to a racist rant is going viral on social media. Thanks very much for your time, Jagmeet.
My pleasure.
A message of love from north of the border seems a wise place to park things today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.